Good to see all of you this morning. If you would please, one more time, open your Bibles to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. I know in our last study we had some questions that, frankly, I didn't know the answer to, and I've done a little bit of research on that. It's kind of a point that I don't want to spend necessarily a whole lot of time on because of the relevance of it. Good to see those of you who are visiting with us, too. Glad you're here. But I do want to try to shed a little more light on some of the things that we discussed in our study last time. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel is prophesying concerning the coming of the Lord's kingdom. It becomes a very big hinge pin in our study of history and geography of the Bible. There are some passages that I want you to know by the time that we're finished with this, be able to recall them and tell me what's in them. So if I do that down the pike somewhere, you will be able to do that, and of course I think they will be helpful to you in your efforts to teach the lost and to be built up and edified in your faith to know that God always does what He says that He will do. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel prophesied concerning the coming of the Lord's kingdom. He's explaining the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had. We've talked about the image, how that it was a head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of brass, and the legs, iron and feet, part of iron and part of clay. And Daniel said that you saw this until a stone was hewn out of the mountain and it smote the image on the feet and it all crumbled. Now, Daniel then begins to explain that dream to King Nebuchadnezzar and say that you, Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold. And after you, there's going to be another kingdom. And after that, there's going to be another kingdom. And then there's going to be a fourth kingdom. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, nor the sovereignty thereof be left unto another people, but it shall break in pieces all these and stand forever. Now the thing that's so impressive about that is he's helping us to see, and we want to be reminded of this, by the way, for the sermon this morning, that the kingdoms of men just don't last. But the kingdom of God does. And as we look at kingdoms of men and we see evil and such things that become pronounced in those kingdoms and even among the leaders of those kingdoms, we become concerned and sometimes a bit blue about the circumstances that might exist in the world and in the society round about us. But let's keep in mind that none of these things are really new. They've always existed, and the kingdoms of men will fall. But that's okay, because we're a part of a kingdom that cannot be shaken, a part of the kingdom of Christ that was prophesied by Daniel. And if our focus is anywhere else, then we're going to be shattered by the things that occur around about us. But in our study this morning, I want us to look that there were a number of kingdoms that had a relationship with Israel, and you're familiar with this. We noted that the Assyrian Empire conquered the northern 10 tribes, leaving the little bitty spot of Judah up here on our map, conditioned upon Hezekiah's continued faithfulness to God. David, question? Comment? Okay. Okay. And then we come to the Babylonian Empire, which conquered the southern kingdom of Judah. The city of Jerusalem fell in 586. And then it was prophesied that there would be another kingdom, and we know that the Medes and the Persians joined forces and conquered the Babylonian Empire. And it was also decreed during the time previously by Isaiah the prophet in Isaiah 44 and 45 that Cyrus, the king of the Persian Empire, would write a decree and allow these who had been taken captive to return home. But Daniel's sequence of kings continues into the intertestamental period where we read of the Grecian Empire. Now, you studied that and we talked about it extensively, and Richard led you in a very rich study regarding this history between the Testaments. Now, somebody has asked me, well, where does the Bible tell us about the Greek kingdom? Well, it doesn't tell us about the Greek kingdom because it's in between the Old and the New Testament, a period that lasted for how long? 400 years. So you wouldn't expect to find anything in the Bible about this, except it was mentioned by Daniel that it would come to pass, there would be a fourth kingdom, and in the days of these kings, the Roman kingdom, the God of heaven would set up His kingdom, which shall never be destroyed. And so that's what we're interested in seeing these things grow and come to pass. This fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, we see it spreading around the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the little area of Judea over here on our map, and we've talked about the Fertile Crescent and why this little piece of real estate was so very important. Whoever owned it controlled commerce and controlled, for the most part, the travel around the Mediterranean Sea. And not just around the Mediterranean Sea, but across the Mediterranean Sea. We know that there was a place, Tyre and Sidon, Tyre in particular, where there was a natural port. And the problem with that, of course, during the days of the Roman Empire, is it would not accommodate the larger ships. So Caesar had a port that was made in this place called Caesarea, or we call it Caesarea. And this then became the prominent port, and Paul went in and out of there a time or two. But what we want to note, it was during the days of these kings that the God of heaven would set up a kingdom which should never be destroyed. Now, very quickly, I want to set the stage for the development of the coming of the kingdom of Christ, just in brief. Now, I had some numbers wrong on my map Wednesday night, and I hope that I've got them corrected. When we look at Rome in its beginning days, it wasn't all that big. Something like what we might refer to as a small town that began to expand and expand and expand. And its first onslaught was against Carthage over here in the years 264 to about 146. Now, that's where I got those early dates, from the beginning of Rome's efforts to expand. Later, during the days of Julius Caesar, we find that he began to go west and Pompey began to go east. Now, Rome did not have just simply one king or ruler, as you've already talked about. It had what was called a republic. And this effort between Julius Caesar and Pompey to spread the borders of the Roman Empire would, as you can see on the map, just naturally create a conflict between these two. But at first, they formed an alliance about 60 B.C. Now, Richard, that puts the date of Pompey's lifetime and so forth in a more proper perspective than putting him down here in 147 or so B.C. But they became allies. Now, interestingly enough, Pompey, if I recall correctly, married the daughter of Julius Caesar. So there was a relationship between these two. But it became soon a power struggle between them. And the stage had been set earlier, 167 B.C., when the kingdom of Syria had invaded the kingdom of Israel and had polluted the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And this was during the days of Antiochus. You've talked about that. And how that he offered swine upon the altar and polluted the temple and polluted the altar and so forth and so on, and led to the days of the Maccabean revolt, where we read of, I believe, Judas Maccabees, who became the military leader in this pursuit to drive the Syrians out of Jerusalem and back up to here. But during this time, there are other things that are taking place regarding Syria. King Antiochus Epiphanes, as he called himself, he wanted to dominate this part of the world. And though his domination wasn't as big as what we've seen with the kingdom of Assyria and Babylon and the Medes and the Persians, yet he was establishing himself as a powerful king in the area. When the Maccabees drove them back, there were some other things that were taking place that presented problems for Syria. We talked about those of India over here that had come this way to somewhat put a stop to the invasion of Syria. And then you have Pompey coming down on behalf of Rome. So you've got Pompey on behalf of Rome coming from the north. You've got the Maccabeans that have already settled into resistance here from the south. And you've got the Indians coming in from the east. And what's beginning to happen to Syria? And Rome just over there, delighted as could be, that it's happening. What's happening to Syria? They're becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. Well, then Pompey comes down and he conquers Syria. Now, in the meantime, Pompey's efforts toward Israel as a whole is that he's coming to help them resolve problems and resistance and so forth with Syria. But when he gets there, what does he do instead of offering help? He takes Jerusalem. That's right. Pompey marches into Jerusalem, and I'll not go into the details of how he conquered the city of Jerusalem, though that's quite interesting. But the fact is, he did. And he went into the temple and defiled the temple. Now, Carolyn asked a very interesting question that made me scratch my head. If he defiled the temple in the same way that Antiochus Epiphanes had earlier, well, let's remember that he did not defile the temple by going in and offering swine upon the altar like Antiochus did. But his presence in the temple defiled the temple. That raises the question then, how do we, by New Testament times, looking at these dates, how do we then, by New Testament times, have the Jews once again in control of the temple and once again offering sacrifices and so forth and so on? And there's a real good answer to that. David?
When he came in, Jews actually thought that when he defiled the temple, he's going to strike dead.
Yeah. They thought God would strike him dead.
Yeah. But he did, and of course, what we do know, his career was virtually over there. But when Herod came in, while Herod's dad came to power, he said that, you know, you're going to have to give these Jews back their religious days. And they had a lot of religious freedom. Even Jews that were in the Roman army could stop and worship on the seventh day. They had that. They could pay temple tax. They had a lot of privileges because the rulers down there convinced Rome that if they did, they're going to have another back.
That's interesting. Now, in the process of time, from what I have read, the very next day after Pompey conquered Jerusalem, the very next day after he walked into the temple, he gave it back to them. He ordered that it be cleansed. He'd proven his victory over them. He ordered that it be cleansed and gave it back to them so that then under, as you said, the rule of Rome, they were permitted to continue with their religion and so forth and so on. So Jerusalem was conquered by Rome about 37 B.C. Now that sets the stage for some things. Octavian is declared then to be the first Roman emperor, titled Augustus Caesar in 27 or so B.C. And that's where we begin to read in the New Testament about these Roman kings being in power. Now, you don't pick up the New Testament and say, well, here's how all this developed. Because all this began to develop during this period of silence between the Testaments. And so we look back at secular history, and here's where we learn what took place that brought us to this point. Now, the title of this particular lesson is Time Draws Near. Time is drawing near for God to do just exactly what He said He would do. But we look at history and we see events that took place that brought that about, brought that to come to pass. And it's important, I believe, for us to be familiar with what some of these events were and be able to explain them. And I apologize Wednesday night for not knowing some of the answers to these questions because they were very relevant questions. They're not dealt with in our lesson text, but they're very relevant questions as to how these things transpired. All right? Ready, Mom? How about I send it to you? Okay. Well, in our next point, we want to talk about how that Pompey went on down into eventually Egypt, and there he was ordered to be killed. This conflict between Julius Caesar and Pompey continued, and Pompey went down into Egypt, and rather than to be responsible for helping Pompey, the Egyptian king ordered that he be murdered. Now, you see why. What's happening to Rome?
What year are we now?
All right. Well, Jerusalem is conquered by Rome about 37. I don't have these points on the board yet.
So it's in the lesson book, Pompey was defeated in 48.
In 48.
Left Egypt and told me the 7th. 12th had him killed.
All right. So we've got him coming down here in this interim somewhere. But he's murdered in Egypt. because the Egyptian king doesn't really want him to to appear to be, let me rephrase that. The Egyptian king doesn't want to appear to be supporting Pompey for fear of Julius Caesar.
Now, Egyptian king, is that Egyptian or is that Roman ruled?
Well, at this time it was Egyptian, somewhat under Roman rule. I don't know how else to say that, because now we've got the Ptolemies down here. The Ptolemies were Greeks, that's right, up here, Antiochus.
Ptolemies were Greeks too.
Well, yes. So they would have come from Rome, is that what we're...
Well, they were still allies with Rome. They haven't been totally conquered.
Okay. Allied with Rome. Come from this area down here. Okay. We've got Cleopatra and Mark Antony and those characters, and you've talked about some of that.
Cleopatra would have been your Ptolemy, Mark Antony would have been your Roman, and they a lot of times back here, I think Pompey married like three or four different women to make an alliance with different ones, and that also went on with the Ptolemy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time. Well, as we pursue our study this morning, we know that Jerusalem was conquered by Rome in 37 B.C. Antipas' son, Herod the Great, was made king of the Jews. And interestingly enough, when we think about the area of Palestine, he was given some position of authority besides just being king. He had the right to enforce what he decided. He was given an army. But yet Judea remained an independent kingdom in this arrangement. In other words, you can do what you want to do as long as you don't do anything that we don't want you to do. Does that make sense? So that was the rule of Rome. This suggests to us the Roman Empire around the Mediterranean Sea and the control that they exerted in this world. Julius Caesar was murdered in 44 B.C., I believe our book quotes that date. Cleopatra was involved in a power struggle, this we've already talked about, and Octavian defeated them in 31 B.C., and Egypt became a Roman province. Do we not see what's taking place? You've got Rome taking all of it, around the Mediterranean Sea, to exercise dominion of the commerce and travel. Octavian was declared the first Roman emperor and given the title Augustus Caesar, and that's where we began in the New Testament with the Gospel of Luke in Luke chapter 1. Now somebody said, well, why don't you begin with Matthew chapter 1? Well, what did we say the Gospel of Luke does that Matthew, Mark, and John do not do? All right, it gives us the chronological order. If you underline things in your Bible, you look at Luke chapter 1, verse 3, and notice the expression, in order. Luke is writing to Theophilus, it says, it seemed good to me, verse 3 also, having traced the course of all things accurately from the first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus. Luke is giving this in chronological order. And then when we read in Luke chapter 1, about the prophecies of the birth of John the Baptist, we've backed up now further in our historical perspective than any of the other Gospels do. In Luke chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, it says, now it came to pass in those days, there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus, that the world should be enrolled. This was the first enrollment made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to enroll themselves, everyone to his own city. I want to come back and talk about that in just a moment. But what we learn is that during the days of Octavian, Augustus Caesar, Jesus would be born. Now, we've looked at this before, and this is here just simply for information's sake. The succession of kings in the early days of the Roman Empire. We've got Octavian, Augustus Caesar, and then Tiberius, Caligula, and then Claudius, and then Nero, who was reigning during the days of Paul's imprisonment. And I want us to think about that in view of the lesson that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. This 400 years of silence, God is now willing to talk to man, and man seems willing to listen. Now, in the text of Luke chapter 1, it says, "There was in the days of Herod, king of Judea." What Herod was that? We'll talk more about that when we get to the life of Christ. But what Herod was this? Herod the Great, yes. Herod the Great, king of Judea. "A certain priest named Zacharias of the course of Abijah, and he had a wife of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. They were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and the ordinances of the Lord blameless, and they had no child because that Elizabeth was barren, and they both were now well stricken in years. Now it came to pass, while he executed the priest's office before God in order of his course, according to the custom of the priest's office, his lot was to enter into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying without at the hour of incense. And there appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zacharias was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, because thy supplication is heard, and thy wife Elizabeth shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John. And thou shalt have joy and gladness, and many shall rejoice at his birth. And then he begins to tell us some things about John. But in verse 16, many of the children of Israel shall he turn unto the Lord their God, and he shall go before his face in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to walk in the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared for him." Now, we talked about Zechariah's response to all of this in our study Wednesday night. But I want to talk with you this morning about some things that we began to discuss Wednesday night, and that is some of these prophecies from the Old Testament now that are beginning to come to pass in the New Testament. Now, when we turn back into the Old Testament to Isaiah chapter 40, we concluded our study, I believe, Wednesday night, talking about approximately what time did Isaiah prophesy. Now, that becomes foundational to a number of things that we want to remember. About when did Isaiah prophesy? About 700 B.C. What was happening in among the people of God about that time? All right, the Assyrian captivity. That's right. We know that Ezekiel comes along and Daniel, and they prophesy about what time? 600. About 600 B.C., yes. And, of course, we have Ezekiel being a captive in the Babylonian period, but we have Daniel not only a captive, but Daniel is in somewhat of a position of prominence. Where was he?
In the capital.
In the capital, that's right. He served under the king. Now, when we look at Isaiah's prophecy, keep in mind now, he's prophesying during a time of the rebellion of Israel to the north, the time of the Assyrian captivity. And in Isaiah chapter 40, look beginning in verse 1. And I need a reader down through verse 5. Isaiah 40, 1 through 5. James, would you do that for me, please? Okay.
Isaiah 40, 1 through 5. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her, that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she hath received of Jehovah's hand double for all her sins. The voice of one that crieth, prepare ye in the wilderness the way of Jehovah. Make level in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the uneven shall be made level, and the rough places a plain. And the glory of Jehovah shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together.
All right. What was John's work? What was John to do? Prepare the way. Now, we use that expression, and rightly so, because it's used here, quoted often in the New Testament. John's job was to prepare the way. But look, if you will, at the description of Isaiah the prophet regarding what that meant. In verse 4, every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the uneven shall be made level, the rough places a plain. When an army is approaching its enemy, what needs to be done to make that approach effective?
You've got to have a way to get there.
That's right. Now, I talked some with Lauren about the work that the Seabees did. When we think about the American military, we don't think too much about the Seabees. We think about the Marines, the Navy, and so forth and so on. But when we talk about the Seabees, what did they do? That's right. They went in, built bridges, cultivated roads, as it were, to make it possible for the army to get to where they needed to be. Now, that's the effective work that John was to do. He was to fill in the valleys, he was to cut down the mountains, and the rough places he was to make smooth so that the Lord could come and do his work. Now, that tells us that primarily John's work was going to be among whom? The Jews. That's right, among the Jews. Now, when we come to the New Testament, let's begin now in Matthew and look at chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. And I think you'll find somewhat here in Matthew chapter 11, something that is repeated over and over. Juan, you mind to read some for me? Matthew chapter 11, would you read for me verse 10? And Bruce, would you have ready Mark chapter 1, verse 2, and we'll read those before we go beyond them. Matthew chapter 11, verse 10.
This is he of whom it is written, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you."
All right, who is it that Matthew is writing about? Who is it that he's applying this prophecy to? This is John, yes. When you go back to verse 2, it says, "Now when John heard in the prison the works of the Christ, that he sent by his disciples, and saith unto him, Art thou he that cometh, or look we for another? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Go and tell John the things which ye see and hear. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have good tidings preached unto them. And blessed is he, whosoever shall find no occasion of stumbling in me." And these went their way, and Jesus began to say unto the multitude concerning John, "What went ye out in the wilderness to behold? A reed shaken with the wind? But what went ye out to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft raiment are in kings' houses. But wherefore went ye out? To see a prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and much more than a prophet." And then he quotes from Isaiah chapter 40. What did they go out to see?
He's quoting from Malachi.
He is. All right. He is. He is. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But what I want us to see is in these quotations, Isaiah chapter 40 is certainly referenced. He's quoting from Malachi chapter 3. We'll read that in just a moment when we get to this second point. But he's talking about the work that John would do. Malachi, when he talks about preparing the way, is essentially repeating the words of Isaiah from Isaiah chapter 40. Before we go further with that, Mark chapter 1, please, Bruce. Beginning in verse 2. You may, yes.
"As it is written in the prophets, behold, I will send a messenger before thy face, he shall prepare thy way before thee. And the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight."
All right, who's Mark quoting? And Isaiah. So both of them have reference to the same thing. Mark is quoting both of them. In Luke's account, in the 7th chapter, and in verse 27, It says, "This is he of whom it is written, Behold, I will send my messenger before thy face, who shall prepare the way before thee." Who's Luke quoting? Well, he's quoting the words of Malachi, but who's Malachi quoting? Essentially, the words of Isaiah. Now, this presents a perplexing problem as we come to the Gospel of John. Yes?
I wouldn't say Malachi is quoting Isaiah. They both have the same inspiration.
All right.
The prophets of God.
I'll buy that. He doesn't simply say word for word the thing that Isaiah had said, but he's dealing with the same subject matter, one that would come and prepare the way of the Lord. Now, the perplexing problem that I wanted to talk with you about is, who is that? That's John. John the Baptist, John the Baptizer. And let us understand, while we're on this point, very quickly we'll make this point unless you have a question. The text is referring to John the Baptist, not John a Baptist. Okay, John didn't begin the Baptist church. And we need to see that clearly. And if you want some more information on when the Baptist church began, so forth and so on, we can look some of that up and talk about it.
He's also called Elijah.
Yes, he is. That's the next point. Hold that thought. Malachi. Okay, when we get to Malachi. But John's problem. Yes.
Just as a point of reference, I was talking to a Muslim one time, and he quoted this verse from Malachi and said that
Ah. Yeah.
And I went to Matthew and I said, Jesus said, that's talking about John.
Yeah, we're going to see these in just a minute, but that's exactly right. He's not talking about Muhammad. Jesus identifies John from the text of Malachi chapter 3 and chapter 4. Now, the problem that I want to talk with you about, a perplexing one it would seem, is that John is indeed the forerunner of the Christ. But there had been a prophecy of the coming of another prophet. Likened to me. Who said that?
Moses
did. Where did I read that? Right there. Yeah, Deuteronomy 18. Beginning in verse 18. 18 and 19. Now question, what was it that Moses said about that prophet? Besides, he'll be like unto me.
Hearing.
That's right. Because if you don't listen to him, what's going to happen to you? You'll be cut off. Now, what we want to see is, when we come to the Gospel of John, considering this lengthy period of silence from God, and now God has begun to communicate through John the Baptist. Now, just to avoid confusion, when we read about John the Baptist, who's writing about him in the Gospel of John? Don't tell me John. Which John? John the Apostle. Thank you. John the Apostle is writing the Gospel of John, and he begins to describe some things about John the Baptist. And if you'll pick up the reading there, beginning at verse 19.
Verse 19.
Chapter 1, I'm sorry. You don't have that open to there? Well, get with the program. John chapter 1, beginning about verse 19. It says, "And this is the witness of John, when the Jews sent unto him from Judea priests and Levites to ask him, Who art thou? And he confessed and denied not, and he confessed, I am not the Christ. And they ask him, What then? Art thou Elijah? And he saith, I am not. Art thou the prophet? And he answered, No. Now the questions that these Jews ask of John the Baptist indicate what?
Verse 21, Art thou the prophet?
That's correct. And who was it that had prophesied concerning the coming of the Messiah? There's a prophet that's coming after. Yes. So that question implies that they understood Moses' prophecy from Deuteronomy chapter 18. Now, when they ask the question, are you Elijah? What does that suggest to us?
Understood Isaiah and
All right, Malachi talked about Elijah coming. So this is evidence that they had some understanding of some of these Old Testament prophecies to the extent of how clear that was. We may not know. But they had some understanding that the Old Testament prophets pointed to the coming of another. Now look at how John responds to some of this. Look at verse 22, the obvious question. They said unto him, therefore, who art thou? That we may give an answer to them that ask us. What sayest thou of thyself? Now their questions too, are you Elijah? No, well he wasn't Elijah. Are you that prophet? Are you the Christ? No, I'm not the Messiah. Well then tell us who you are, so that we can report to those who would ask. And he said in verse 23, he said, I am the voice of the one crying in the wilderness. Make straight the way of the Lord, as said Isaiah the prophet. Now, several things. We say, well, John was an inspired man. That's right. But John knew what other inspired men had said. Who's he quoting? Isaiah chapter 40. He says it. As Isaiah said, that's who I am. And they asked him and said unto him, why then baptizest thou if thou art not the Christ? Neither Elijah, neither the prophet. And John answered them, saying, I baptize in water. In the midst of you standeth one whom ye know not, even he that cometh after me, the latchet of whose shoe I am not worthy to unloose. These things were done in Bethany beyond the Jordan, where John was baptizing. Now let's pause right there. John the Baptist understands he's not who they think he is. Yes, Juan?
I mean, earlier what I understood you guys were saying was that he was saying that I'm not the prophet being Christ, but then
correct.
He sits there and says, oh no, the Pharisees sit there and say, are you not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? So why the three distinctions if the prophet meant Christ?
I'm not sure that there's really a distinction to be made between those. The prophet of which Moses was speaking of was the Messiah, the Christ. I don't know if they're just duplicate. I can't answer that. I don't know.
Well, or maybe they didn't understand that it was, you know, they didn't have a full understanding of it.
Well, that's, you know, that's a possibility. I just don't know.
It seems, you think of John Baptist as a prophet.
Oh, yes. Yes, they thought of him as a prophet. But they didn't like the one of whom he prophesied. And so that puts them at odds with John, and we'll see why in just a little bit. But as this text continues, look, the very next day, on the morrow, when you're reading from the gospel accounts or from any of the books of the Bible, I want you to notice expressions like that. Because a timetable we found in our study to be very helpful many times. And to see the relevance of one event to the other is very helpful in our study. And it tells us, on the morrow, he seeth Jesus coming unto him and saith, behold the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. This is he of whom I said, after me cometh a man who is become before me, for he was before me, and I knew him not. But that he should be made manifest to Israel, for this cause came I baptizing in water. Now John's statement sounds really confusing in a lot of ways. This is he who was before me. But I didn't know him. But he was before me. How was Jesus before John?
It's pretty good because John was born 6 months earlier. But he's talking about Jesus, the Son of God.
That's right. Jesus existed long before the birth of John. In fact, one of the attributes of deity is to be eternal. And Jesus always was. So John's statement here applies to the deity of Jesus. But why then did John baptize? All right, to fulfill all righteousness. Yes, this was the right thing for him to do. But let's take that just one step further. To prepare the way, yes.
Baptism of repentance.
Yes, you can tell I'm searching for something. John baptized so that folks would know who Jesus is. Look, if you will, in the text as it continues. Verse 32. And John bare witness, saying, I beheld the Spirit descending as a dove out of heaven, and it abode upon him, and I knew him not. But he that sent me to baptize in water, he said unto me, upon whomsoever thou seest the Spirit descending and abiding upon him, the same is he that baptizeth in the Holy Spirit. And I have seen and have borne witness that this is the Son of God. Now, John baptized to prepare the way. John baptized a baptism of repentance. All these things are true. But what was the main focus of John's preaching? To identify who Jesus is. He is the Christ. He is the Son of God. Now, what would be the evidence of that? God, who had instructed John to baptize, had told John, here's evidence. Now, John baptized a lot of people, but he only baptized one that did this. What was unique about this? The Spirit of God descended upon him and remained. Now, John said, I saw it, and I declare unto you that this is the Christ. This is the Son of God. Any questions or comments just there before we continue to the second point on the chart? Yes, Randy?
I was just beginning to think about what Juan was asking about the three different questions.
Okay.
It seems to me that they are kind of what Carolyn said. They're making reference to different prophecies.
Okay.
Because the people that said, let's see, who are you if you confess but did not deny, but confess I am not the Christ? If anybody was accusing him of being the Christ or asking if he was the Christ, well, the Christ is the Greek translation of Messiah.
Right.
Daniel prophesied about the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah.
Right.
You know, by using that word. I don't think Isaiah used the word Messiah that I'm aware of.
I'd have to do a search to see.
And then Elijah, that's a direct reference to the last two verses of Malachi.
Right.
Where it identifies Elijah by name. And then, of course, the prophet is going back to Deuteronomy.
Right, right.
Said there will be a prophet.
That's right.
So I think that's the explanation for that, is that they're identifying different prophecies, not recognizing that they're the same.
Right.
Pointing to the same person.
Yeah, so the idea of distinction, not necessarily true, distinction in persons, might be distinctions in prophecy. Could very well be, keeping in mind that prophet and the Messiah were one and the same.
Yeah, you remember also that Jesus' apostles asked him, you know, when will be the time of your coming? When will be the time of these things? And when will be, you know, ask him essentially three, what turned out to be different questions that they all thought were the same.
Yeah, exactly. Matthew 24, on into 25, I believe. Yeah, exactly right. Okay, well, there's another point I want us to see on this chart. Malachi, it's come up several times. I'm sorry, Jenny.
Sorry, just real quick. I did a quick search. Messiah is not mentioned until the New Testament.
Okay.
Right. So
okay.
It's neither one of those terms are relevant.
Okay, all right. Malachi, chapter 4. All right, in Malachi, chapter 4. Malachi has addressed a lot of subjects to these people, identifying their indifference. Malachi writes during the period of restoration. The people are back in Jerusalem, back in Judea. They're worshiping and serving God in the temple. They're not worshiping idols anymore. But what are they doing in terms of their worship and service? That's right. And if you'll notice in verse 10 of chapter 1, Malachi says, the words of God, oh, that there were one among you that would shut the doors, that ye might not kindle fire on mine altar in vain. I have no pleasure in you, saith Jehovah. Well, they're worshiping him, but as Jenny has said, they're just bringing the leftovers. They're bringing that which they think is about to die anyway. Now, you'd be happy to give something like that away, wouldn't you? You want to give it to the Lord? Now, that's what they were doing. Sometimes all we're interested in doing is we examine our life, and after I've taken everything that I want out of my time, then what might be left, I can give that to the Lord. Let me ask you think He's satisfied with that? Now, we've got to consider that, brethren. We've remarked before that the Lord won't take second place. It's first or none with Him. Now, these people obviously understood that because they said, take what you've got, or the Lord said, take what you've got and offer it to your governor and see if he'll accept it. Now, do you do that with your taxes? In paying your taxes, do you have any recognition up here that the time's going to come when X amount of dollars is going to have to be given to the government? Do you ever plan toward that or think about that throughout the course of the year? Or do you wait till April the 15th and say, oh no, I spent all my money and now I've got all this gazillion amount of dollars I'm supposed to pay for taxes. But you see, I have this old rusty dollar bill over here. I'll send that to the government. You think they're satisfied? Not hardly. But that's the idea that these people had about God. Several instances of that are cited in the book of Malachi. But if you come down to the concluding verses of Malachi, he says in chapter 4, verse 4, remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel, even statutes and ordinances. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the great and terrible day of Jehovah come. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now, as you come to New Testament times and you say, well, that Old Testament prophet Elijah is going to be resurrected. No. You read the book of Malachi and that's what you're thinking. And that would evidently explain John chapter 1 and the understanding of the Jews concerning who John was. Are you Elijah? No, he wasn't Elijah. He wasn't the Old Testament prophet Elijah. But as you come into the New Testament and read concerning the comments of Jesus, Jesus identifies who this is. Matthew chapter 11, verse 14. And if you're willing to receive it, this is Elijah that is to come. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Who's Jesus talking about as the Elijah that is to come? John the Baptist, that's right. You back up two or three verses, it becomes apparent. And I'd like for you to look at these other two passages and see if you find the same thing to be true. We'll begin there next time.
You know, the Jews after this Malachi, during Passover, they set up a chair for Elijah. They had a chair there, they had cups, and they filled it. They had no water to drink for. That was for Elijah because he was coming. So the Jews,
very good. I didn't know that. That's very good. Thank you for your comments and participation.